He's experienced everything Hoosier hysteria has to offer. Great thrills, bitter disappointments, even tragedy. Growing up in Sullivan, Indiana, football was the first sport to get into his blood, but it wasn't long before basketball stole his heart. He moved to Newcastle before his sophomore season thrust him into the hotbed of the North Central Conference. Before he knew it, he was the star of one of the best teams in the state. He played in one of Indiana's all-time classic high school games against Jimmy Rail and Kokomo, outscoring Rail 51-49 in the final game of the 1959 season. He accepted a scholarship to Indiana University and started some games as a sophomore. But before his junior year, he was involved in an automobile accident that left him paralyzed. He went on to get his degree and became a high school coach, a successful one at that, but not so good that he couldn't overcome small-town politics and keep his job. He went on to a career in school administration, and even today remains as well-connected to the game as anyone in the state. His is a story of triumph, followed by tragedy, followed by ultimate triumph. So let's get to it. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Ray Pavey.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Well, today, One-on-One comes to you from the Pebblebrook Golf Course, where the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame is conducting its annual golf outing. And we're here with a historical figure in Indiana basketball, Ray Pavey from Newcastle, Indiana. And we got a lot to talk about with you, Ray, so let's jump in. You grew up in Sullivan. Before you moved to Newcastle.
My father was a minister, and we moved to Sullivan during my first grade year, and then we moved to Newcastle between my freshman and sophomore year.
Did you move because of church?
Yes.
He was assigned to a different church?
He had the church there in Newcastle. It was sort of interesting because we moved on August 14th. And back then, August 15th, you started football practice. Well, we didn't have any place to stay, so I stayed all night with the superintendent at Sullivan, who was Phil Eskew.
Oh, and who became head of the IHSA.
He became head of the IHSA because he had to speak at Newcastle on the 15th. And so he tells the story. He's the only superintendent in the state of Indiana that took an All-American out of his school corporation to another school corporation to play.
So growing up in Sullivan, were you already immersed in sports there? That's a small community, of course. And
it was a football school. Mm-hmm. During that period of time when I was going to school, we were Sullivan was third and fourth, fifth in the state year after year, and really didn't have a lot of interest in basketball, to be truthful.
So you were primarily a football guy growing up.
I was still a basketball guy.
Tell me about your interest in basketball then. What sparked it? What players and teams were you following? You know, what got you going?
Well, initially, of course, I was born during the Depression and then World War II. So there was no such thing as rubber basketballs for anybody other than schools. So what happens is you rolled up a pair of socks, you got a tin can if you could find one, cut the top and bottom out of it, and you put that up on the side of a wall or out in the garage, and so you became a shooter with a rolled up pair of socks, and you weren't very good dribbling, but you but you become a great shooter during that period of time. So when I was young, that's really how I started. And it's sort of interesting. It has twofold effect. Number one, after you have your parents keep score for you for a little time, they finally say, you have to learn to keep score yourself. And so you learn to add, and you played both teams, and you were more of a shooter than you were anything else.
This is in your bedroom or the side of the house?
I had one in the garage. I had one in the living room. Probably drove my parents crazy, but it was awful lot of fun for me.
So what teams were you? Say you're being both teams. What teams? High school teams? Or?
Well, we were high school teams in Westport, Indiana. Sand Creek was the name of the high school. You had Greensburg was the county seat. You always, as the old saying goes, anybody that's not in Greensburg and Decatur County hates Greensburg.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
that's the way it was.
They were the big city.
They were the big city school. So you did that. I was a, even back then, I was a big, big fan of Indiana. And we were pretty close to Shelbyville. So I could listen to the Shelbyville basketball games in 47. And, of course, they won the state championship then. And Garrett was playing at that particular time. And the, you know,
yeah,
they
Bill
were.
Garrett, yeah.
You know, they, and back then, schools traveled more and played. When Shelbyville played Terre Haute Garfield that at the state tournament, well, that's not the first time they played them. They played them during the season, too. Mm-hmm. You know, we just had a lot more of that. You know, New Albany might travel to East Chicago to play. There, it's just a whole different ball game today than what it was then. You know, the people back in the late 40s and early 50s in Newcastle talk about taking the train to New Albany and play New Albany on one night and play Jeffersonville on the next night, stay overnight there, and then get on the train and come back to Newcastle.
Mm, road trips.
Road trips were different at that particular time.
So were you? Was your interest sparked mainly by listening to games on the radio?
Listening to games on the radio.
Not much on television.
It didn't exist.
Yeah, and not until the late 40s. Yeah.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, radio was the real, you know, the word pictures were really, really good at that time. You had some really great announcers, and, you know, Tom Carnegie was there by that time, and you just, every big city had an announcer, and you ended up becoming very much attached to that particular announcer. You listened, and their particular idiosyncrasies, you understood by the time the third ball game was there.
Yeah.
You know, you knew what a pick and roll was going to look like if you were at the game. You knew what happened if somebody did a rocker step and went this way. They were just great communicators at that particular time. And so we've gone from that to today, where in television they don't talk very much. They let the game play out. Well, back then it was the radio. They had to give you the word picture right for your mind.
So when you're listening to those games on the radio, you're dreaming of what, playing in the state tournament, that type of thing? And
yeah, you do all the dreams. You dream you beat the good team. you just dream you get a play.
Yeah.
You know, it's like everything else. Sort of a unique story. My father and mother both grew up in Ripley County. My dad played for New Marion, which probably his senior class had 6-8 people in it. They practiced out on the cinders outside. They went one day a week to Sunman to practice inside. But the whole thing came down to the process that they were really a good team his senior year, but he got the measles before the finals of the sectionals, and they lost.
Mm.
And so one of the real driving forces that he had was he really wanted me to be able to play in a sectional basketball championship. And sometimes I think when he was looking at churches, that was more of an impact than some of the other things. You know, maybe God spoke kindly to him in some cases, but he was more interested in, was it a county seat, and did they have their own sectional?
When it'd be with a big school, too.
With a big school,
so your move to Newcastle was something he initiated, not necessarily the church saying you need to go there?
That's correct.
Okay.
And yeah. I did not want to go.
Yeah.
You know, our Sullivan basketball team in my class was really good. When we were playing together on the reserve team for the season, this is for the season, our team shot 57%.
Wow.
Not one game. Jim Hartman, who was our coach at that time, still has all the records, because he says, nobody will believe me if I can't produce the records.
Yeah. So you moved to Newcastle, and you're a freshman year, right?
No, between my freshman and sophomore
Between your year. Freshman and sophomore year. Okay,
yes.
So you're kind of coming into the scene late there, but that's a big school, you know, relative to other schools at that time, at least.
Yes, yeah.
And it played in a gym that held 1,800 or 1,900 people, which, again, at that time was a big gymnasium.
Yeah, it was. Although, interestingly, Sullivan's was bigger than that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was about 2,000.
Pavey recalls a childhood among the temptations of Hoosier hysteria and a move into the very heart of it when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One on One. Mark Monteith here with Hoosier basketball legend Ray Pavey. He grew up listening to high school and college basketball games on the radio and later watching them on television. By the time his father moved the family to Newcastle and into the North Central Conference, he was all in.
So what is the first state championship you remember watching on television?
My first state championship that I remember watching was in 48. I got to see a little bit of it on television. And in Sullivan, there was a store that had that sold televisions. And what they did was set it up, and if you wanted to go look at it, you could stand outside the window and watch the basketball game. So that's how I watched my first state championship.
Now, that's a classic Hoosiers moment there of Indiana basketball, standing outside a television store, looking through the window, watching the state championship.
Watching
game
the state
on
championship with your coat on, your.
Because this would have been on a Saturday night.
Yeah, your gloves on, hat, the whole bit, trying to make out in the snow forest of the little round TV that was probably. Maybe an 8-inch at that particular time.
Yeah, like how many people would be watching this game out there?
Well, there were a few.
Yeah.
There were a few. So that was the first one I saw. The first one that I attended was in 51 when Muncie Central beat Evansville Wrights. And I did not go to the full tournament. I got a ticket for the night. The county superintendent went to my dad's church in Sullivan, so he always got tickets for the state championship. Somehow I never got them, though.
Never filtered down to you. Huh?
Never filtered down. It was always a dad thing.
You were telling me a little while ago, though, that you went to the Attucks championship game in 1955, right?
Oh, I went to that. The first time I saw Attucks play, though, was in 53.
Oh, okay.
54.
Okay. Well, 54 when they played Milan.
54. Attucks played Columbus. Columbus was the number one in the state at that particular time. Everybody thought they were going to win the state championship. I mean, it was a given. And so my brother-in-law and sister were going to Butler. And so I got on the bus in Sullivan, Indiana, and got a sport magazine. And I think I got another magazine. I just remember one of them was Sport Magazine, so I could read all the way up. And they picked me up at the bus terminal in downtown Indianapolis. We rode the bus out to Butler where they lived, and they lived about three blocks from what was then Butler Fieldhouse, now it's Hinkle. And I'm not sure how I got a ticket for the game, except the person that lived next door to them was a physics professor at Butler, and he helped take tickets. Okay. So I may have gotten in that way.
Yeah.
Surely the statutes of limitations are over at this particular point
I think in time.
And so I sat in the top row on the west end, and I was the only white person in that whole section, and the guys that were there were just absolutely wonderful to me. So in that particular game, Oscar wasn't starting then, but Columbus got a big lead on him. Oscar came in and he was just incredible. I thought, wow, I don't think I've ever seen anybody like this, and I hadn't.
This would have been a sophomore year?
This would have been his sophomore year.
Yeah.
So they came back and won right at the last, and then Milan and Attucks played that night.
Milan won by 12 or 13 points.
Yeah, it was not a one-pointer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, that was my first introduction to Hinkle Fieldhouse, and it was just a wonderful day.
It must have seemed like just a massive palace of some kind, you know, that held 14,000-15,000 people at that time.
It was incredible.
How old were you then? We're talking 1954.
You've
been 11.
Had not got to my 12th birthday yet.
Okay. And I would imagine growing up in Sullivan, you had not had much interaction with black people. So to go sit in the attic section like that had to be an eye opener for you.
It was a wonderful teaching experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had one black in my class at Sullivan. And we probably had maybe two families. And so this was a real eye-opener, but I found myself, you know, you laughing, you say you fall in love with these people. You do. Mm-hmm. You know, they were good to me. They were taking care of me. And they immediately became friends.
Yeah.
And you think, boy, there is nothing like an athletic event to break down all the barriers.
Yeah.
You know, they really have made a difference in the way people in Indiana act.
Yeah.
And they, I'm sure some of them didn't think it was all that good, but
yeah,
really,
it wasn't all, you know, sunshine really and rainbows, but
you know, you really took big jumps and it isn't but a year from that until you get Gary Roosevelt and Maddox playing for the state championship. Now you got two black schools.
Right.
And there were some that would say, you know, we should never let it in the IHSA. You know, we really had some prejudiced people out there.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. No question. As a player, did you have, as a kid growing up, have any embarrassing moments on the basketball court?
Oh, yeah. Know? My first and most embarrassing moment, it's my first game playing for Newcastle, Indiana.
Sophomore.
I'm a sophomore. We were playing at Greenfield. We had a 6'7 center that played on the Wittenberg National Championship team in the NCAA, and he tipped the ball to me, and I take off towards our basket. Unfortunately, I just keep running on, going right into the wall. That's about as embarrassing as she could get.
The wall was close to the end of the court?
Well, about 6 feet. I just kept right on going. I
kind of lost control.
I was making it happen, I guess.
Did he hit the shot, though? You hit the layup?
No, I just ran into the wall.
Oh, you didn't even shoot the ball.
Didn't even shoot the ball. Just ran into the wall.
Now, were you dribbling with your head up?
Yeah. And as you know, Pavey's such a great shooter. He didn't even shoot the first time he got the ball.
Just ran into a wall.
Ran into a wall.
Maybe you're trying to prove to your coach he'd run through a wall for him.
Well, huh? I hadn't thought about that.
So you're at Newcastle. Let's jump ahead. Your senior year. You know, you're part of one of the most famous, I'd say, regular season high school games in the state of Indiana. You know, at Kokomo Newcastle, two North Central Conference teams, last game of the year, last game in the Church Street Gym, right?
Right.
Obviously a sold-out audience. You and Jimmy Rail, two of the leading scorers in the state. What did you average your senior year in high school, roughly?
Between 24 and 25.
Okay, and Jimmy was close to 30, I think, probably 29 or something like that, because he shot more than you did.
Well,
Jimmy,
I don't know about that.
Everybody did.
Trust me, he was a great shooter.
Oh, I know he was. I'm just teasing him because he's a friend.
I think he has the best range of any shooter I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. He'd just barely cross half court line.
I mean, that was a good shot. His concept was, you know, you don't wait for the game to come to you. You shoot. And I said, well, Jim, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, he would put it up. No
he
question.
Would put it up.
So people need to understand the setting here. It's a big game. It's a conference game. Two of the leading scorers in the state. The last game to be played at this gym because the 9,000-seat palace is under construction already.
Not only under construction, the steel all fell back in June, and so when we should have been playing there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
the okay. The steel girders all twisted one noon and just crashed to the floor.
Delayed it all, huh?
Yeah. So we didn't get a chance to play in that place.
Were there people in Newcastle who thought they were crazy for building a 9,000-plus seat gym in that town?
No. Not a single person.
It was needed. Huh?
You have to remember a little bit. To put this in perspective, originally, the initial money raised for that particular gymnasium was raised by the people. They had bake sales. They had car washes. They had all kinds of things. Sold pencils. I'm trying to think what else was. I just moved in the middle of this whole process.
Okay.
But it wasn't unusual for a class in the high school to have a car wash and give all the money to what they call the Gym Now Fund.
Wow. Gym Now, huh?
Gym Now was the corporation that was formed, and the process was very simple. We are going to get the regional away from Muncie. I mean, that's pure and simple. Yeah. That was it.
Had to have a bigger gym than Muncie had.
A bigger gym than Muncie was the key process.
Theirs was probably about 7,000 or something like that. Yeah. So Newcastle built the ones about 9,200, 9,300. Yeah.
And so the first 200,000 or so was raised on those simple things that like I say, on bake sales and on car washes and pencil soils and all that. You know, you think of that today and you think, you know, why would a community do that? Well, you got to remember, life was a little different then. The people who lived in Newcastle tended to work in Muncie or Anderson. I remember when I first became assistant superintendent in Newcastle, we did a this would have been 76, and we did a survey of where did the parents of our kids, our students, work. And over 52% of them worked in Anderson.
Tied one of the factories there.
Tied to General Motors.
Yeah.
And, of course, at that particular line, General Motors had 48,000 workers up there. And,
yeah.
And so what happened is you may be working right next to a guy from Muncie on the line, or you might be next to the person from Marion, or you might, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. And so who won on Friday night was important. I mean, you had a whole week of giving it to the other guy.
Pavey and Jimmy Rail have a classic shootout when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith with former Newcastle and IU basketball player Ray Pavey. He was a star at Newcastle High School, but he never shone any brighter than the night he went up against Kokomo in the final regular season game of his senior year. It's one of the most historic high school regular season games in the state's history. Let's hear all about it.
Let's talk about that last game in Church Street Gym. It's Kokomo and Newcastle. Jimmy Rail, Ray Pavey, two of the leading scorers in the state. It winds up Newcastle winning 92-81. Your team won.
You're supposed to win at home.
That's right. You had home court advantage, I guess. You scored 51 points, and Jimmy Rail scored 49. Yeah. So you two combined for 100 points.
To put this in better perspective so people can understand, we were number two in the state at that time. And Kokomo was either eighth or ninth.
Okay.
So we're not talking about Chalk Bliver playing.
Right.
Here,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, these were really, really good teams that had really won. And in fact, had Kokomo won that night and Muncie Central lost, they would have won the conference.
Okay.
If we win and Muncie Central loses, we win the conference. Now you got the conference scoring champ that was sort of another thing that was. That was on the line. But there were lots of things happening right then that made that a really important game for all the people who are around our community as well as
Kokomo.
People from Kokomo.
Yeah, every once in a while you have a game where there's like five or six storylines going on, you know, where there's just a huge amount of interest and a lot riding on that game, and this was certainly one of them. What's interesting is you scored 51 points, but you only had like four in the first quarter, and you missed a bunch of layups.
I missed a bunch of layups. It's the worst quarter of basketball I've ever played.
Because you were nervous, probably?
You know, I'm not sure why. One of the things that's sort of interesting, and you who have played basketball will remember, in most of the gyms of that age, the dressing rooms were underneath the stands.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, by the time game time started, it was rocking and rolling.
And you could hear that when
you're getting
dressed.
I mean,
yeah.
The pounding on the bleachers were, you know, it was an incredible noise. And if you weren't up by then, you were going to get up before. So we were in a locker room on one side. They were in a locker room on the other. The people were excited, we'll put it that way.
Jimmy got his points, you know, from long distance as he usually did, and you were getting yours on layups for the most part, right?
One of the interesting sidelights that probably nobody knows about that happened in this particular game, one of our forwards, his name is Bill Fisher, and he's an oncologist, you know, really bright, really bright. And our huddles were open huddles. Everybody got a chance to talk on a timeout. And so we came back in, this was in the second quarter, and we came back in a timeout. I don't remember if we called it or they called it. Didn't make any difference. But anyway, Bill Fisher turned and looked at me and says, you know, he says, I think if I went up and sat in the top row of the bleachers, my man would go right with me. And I said, well, why don't you try it? Well, he did go up into the stands a little bit.
He went over by the stands.
Yeah, and so you could really drive when that happens.
Cleared the lane for you.
Cleared the lane.
And you just kept driving to the lane. Yep. And they never switched to a zone or did anything, did they?
No, the person who was guarding me originally was Chuck Fawcett. Now Chuck was a state long jump champ. From Kokomo, and he turned his ankle in the first quarter.
Ah, there's a break for you.
Yeah. And he was really a good defensive player. And I don't think Chuck played again until the state finals.
Okay, so that helped you out also.
Yes.
So tell me about your recruiting experience. You're one of the top players. You're an Indiana All-Star. Any memories from the Indiana All-Star Series against Kentucky? I know Jimmy was Mr. Basketball in 1959. You were on that team, though.
You know, what I'd already found out, and I think kids have to come to this understanding. If I was going to play at the next level, I was going to play being a passer, not a scorer. Jim was going to be a scorer. And so by the time we get to the All-Star game, I'd already shut down the scoring process and knew passing was what was going to get me playing time. So I didn't have a great All-Star game. I had a lot of fun. Gosh,
yeah.
It was fun.
I mean, I've seen the box scores, and he had 4 points in one game. I think he didn't score much. Didn't shoot much either.
But it was fun. Recruiting was different then. I made two visits, one to Indiana and one to Purdue. I had two coaches outside of those two universities that visited me. Lewis from University of Houston.
Guy Lewis from Houston.
Houston. And the Vanderbilt coach that was up, and he got a lot of Indiana players that played at Vanderbilt at that time. Cliff Wells from Tulane had a basketball camp at Newcastle, and he sort of talked to me, but not significantly.
Yeah,
that's it. My dad had pretty much said, there's no need for you to be going here, there, and everywhere. You know, we want to get you an education, if you're going to play, why don't you play where your family can see you?
Yeah.
I had a love affair with Indiana.
You'd grown up in Southern Indiana?
Grew up in Southern Indiana. Had been to the old field house down in the middle of campus a number of times. When I had an opportunity, that was it.
Yeah, so there's no real hard decision for you to make.
Was no real hard, and McCracken, I mean, the Bear was an enormous person.
About 6'5".
Yeah, and he walked through your front door. I mean, it had an impact on you.
Yeah.
And when he took you through the Indiana Memorial Union, walking ahead of you, everybody turned and looked.
So your freshman year, you're not eligible for varsity then, but how did that go as a freshman down there?
Well, you can't play. You're playing inter-squad games.
No freshman schedule?
No freshman schedule. I happened to split my little finger, and so I was in a cast for about 10 weeks. But that's okay, and then that healed okay. And so,
yeah, but you felt like you belonged, like you were a Big Ten player.
I knew that I could do things that would help us win.
So then your sophomore season, you are – playing varsity then, of course. How did that go?
Well, I started 6 or 7, 8 ball games, played very well against some of them, and didn't play so well against others.
Pavey drives head on into a life-changing moment when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with Ray Pavey. His basketball career at IU had gotten off to a promising start as a sophomore, but his career and his life met a dramatic turning point one day on Highway 41. Shortly before your junior season, you had the auto accident.
Yeah, I'm going to a fraternity brother's wedding on Labor Day weekend, heading to Highland, Indiana. Happened to be taking my sister and her family back to meet my brother-in-law, who was stationed in Great Lakes, and we're going to drop them off and go to the wedding and then come back. And then got hit by a truck carrying racehorses. Hmm. Fiance was killed.
Your fiance was killed. Yeah. Yeah. You're on a 2-lane highway?
Yeah, 41.
And did the truck just go over and head on, or hit you head on? Or?
And so I had a nephew that had to have, I don't think it's a plastic skull, but a skull made out of metal and formed in plastic. He's done very well. But and so that day, you're in the hospital at St. Elizabeth's in Lafayette, and the doctor looks at you and says, you're never going to walk again. And I wanted to say, yeah, but in 6 weeks, basketball practice starts.
Yeah. You can't process that, can you?
No, you can't process it.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to do. But I've been fortunate.
Yeah.
Lots of good things have happened to me.
Sure. Now, the person driving the truck, what happened with him?
I have no idea.
And is this the kind of situation where somebody could file charges, or is there any repercussion for? I mean, did he fall asleep? Was he drunk? Or
no, I don't think anything. I think it was just a place where it's very dangerous. That's up near Kentland.
Narrow 2-lane road.
Yep.
And he crossed over pulling horses. Were you wearing a seatbelt?
I don't think so.
This is really before seatbelts were commonplace. So you're lucky to live, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thrown out. Probably broke my back when the door slammed on it.
Yeah.
At least that's what doctors tell me. So, but like I say, I've been fortunate and had opportunities to do lots of interesting things. And
oh yeah, you had a career, which we'll talk about. But how do you deal with it when the doctor tells you you'll never walk again? And how long does it take to get over that? And how do you cope with not only the loss of your basketball career, but just the loss of the ability to walk?
If I'm truthful, I would say still haven't.
Really?
it just takes, I don't know. I don't think you ever come to a total acceptance of the whole process. You know, you do because you live in a wheelchair, but.
It's still hard to believe.
It's something, you know, I still can remember the words. And like I say, I was really fortunate. A lot of people helped me do lots of things. And so I've been really blessed in so many ways.
Your father is a Baptist minister. How does he explain or deal with it on his own terms?
You know, we never had that conversation.
Like, I talked to Chuck Babis, and he had a similar experience, and he talked like, well, it was just kind of meant to be this way, and there was a reason it happened. Do you look at it that way, or was it just a really bad bit of luck?
I don't think it was necessarily supposed to happen, but it that way. I don't have a good answer for those kinds of questions.
Yeah, there isn't one, I don't think. Did you finish school at IU?
Finished school at IU. I was out a year while I was getting healed up.
Mm-hmm.
Then fortunately, President Wells, who is an incredible president of the university.
Herman B. Wells.
Herman called me in and says, we will make sure that you can have every class you want. If you'll just tell me what you have to have, I'll move classes so you can have them where you can get in. And he did, with the exception of one. And I couldn't take the zoology class because it was on the third floor of the chemistry building. And this doesn't come as a big surprise, but they didn't want to give a key to the freight elevator in the chemistry building to some student.
It's understandable.
So I
ended up, he was literally moving classes to different locations so you could go.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. But that was the kind of person he was.
So you didn't go, it doesn't sound like you went through a prolonged period of bitterness and why me and that type of thing.
Well, I won't say I didn't go in through any of it, no, again, the university was wonderful for me. I mean, they made it happen so I could get my degree. Now, at that particular point in time, and I wanted to be a basketball coach in the high school level, for you to be eligible to be a basketball coach at high school level, you had to have a physical education degree.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant they had to move lots of stuff for me.
How do you get a phys ed degree when you're in a wheelchair at the moment?
That's what everybody wanted to know. I mean, the professors wanted to laugh, know. Well, you talk about things that you learn to do mentally to walk. You know, you don't have to always show how to do something if you can talk people through the process of doing it, or if you have somebody else that can do it.
Mm-hmm. So you became a coach, and you coached at three different high schools, right?
I got my first job at Sulphur Springs High School, 92 kids.
Is this right out of college?
I worked 1 year in industry because at that particular point in time, people says, you can't teach in a wheelchair. So I got an opportunity in my second year to teach at Middletown. The third year, there was a job opening at Sulphur Springs, which was part of the same corporation, Middletown, Caddis, and Sulphur Springs. They had won 0 games the year before. The year before that, they'd won 1, and the year before that, they'd won 2. So in the past 3 years, they'd won a total of 3 games. Well, I knew some of the kids that were playing there, and I thought, this really is a pretty good place to play. So I applied for the job. I think I was the only person that applied. And in fact, one of the members of the school board said, why in the world do you want this job? They're terrible. I said, I don't think so. So we had a little gym. I had 3 rows of bleachers on each side, and then we had a balcony that had 3 rows of bleachers, and I'm not sure they ever filled it up. And the floor was like 57 feet long and 32 feet wide.
Oh, wow.
And so I decided pretty quickly after I got there we weren't going to play any games at home. Because I thought we had some pretty quick kids. Mm-hmm. We thought, if I can get a big court, I can make people play against us, and I don't think they can beat us. And so we played all of our games on the road, and we won 12 games that year. So that
huge was, step forward. Yeah.
So that was fun.
Sure.
In fact, you know, probably in retrospect, I coached baseball, and they were great baseball players. It certainly had nothing to do with my coaching, but we just beat everybody around us. Because I had 2 good pitchers, a good catcher, and they just mowed people down. And I coached cross country. Now, we weren't all that good in cross country, but we were acceptable. And so it was a great year of my life.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. The kids had never won, and now they all of a sudden did.
They won 12 games. Yeah. And what was the record?
12-7, I think.
Okay, so a winning record.
Yeah. In fact, we're playing our second game, and we'd won our first game, and we're playing in overtime, and we're playing in the second overtime, and I call timeout, and I'm going absolutely crazy. And finally, one of the guards looked at me and said, look, we didn't win as many games last year as you've already won this year. Why are you so excited? So I guess that puts it into perspective.
Yeah, but the community must have gone, you know, a little bit crazy winning 12 games.
They were very, very supportive.
Yeah.
Although they still had the conversations in the barbershop and the automobile dealership about whether I was playing all the right kids or not.
Exactly. Sure. Absolutely. That has to go along with it.
Yeah. You know, yeah. When the whole thing in Hoosiers, when they were talking about their job, I thought, I've been there. I can put names to every one of these people.
There's always the guys in the community think you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So what was it like coaching from a wheelchair, though? Obviously, you can't move around the court with the kids and stuff. I would think, in a way, it makes them listen to you better because they've got to, you know, really be paying attention.
Yes. But that's not unlike all the rest of the coaches. They may be standing up, but you're still trying to put together, you know, basketball is a very complex game that's made very easy when you get 2 people playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get 2 people playing pick and roll or pick and pop or pick and slide or whatever, or if you pass, you can cut opposite, you can pass, you can cut by the ball, you can pass and go pick. You know, all of them are pretty simple once you get in your mind that these are pretty simple things to do as long as I'm doing it with intensity.
Yeah.
And once you win a game or two and they think, well, by gosh, maybe he does know something, it becomes an easier process.
Mm-hmm. How many years did you coach? And you also coached in Middletown and Shenandoah. How many years did you coach?
Coached in Shenandoah 6 years.
Okay.
And won a sectional there, which was fun. my greatest negative thing in coaching, I suppose, was we were playing Muncie Central in the finals of the regional, up 17 points in the third quarter, and we couldn't get the officials to call a charging foul. Oh. So we fouled out all of our good kids, and they came back and beat us.
You were at Muncie Central.
No, we were at Newcastle.
Oh, you're at Newcastle. Okay, yeah. Of course. You're playing at Newcastle. And how big was Shenandoah enrollment, roughly?
400.
Okay, so 400 students playing mighty Muncie Central, and you're up 17 in the third quarter.
Yeah. And then it all came apart.
Yeah. Well,
that's the way it is.
Yes, it is. Every coach experiences that eventually, yeah. I'm sure. So
at some point in time.
Did being in a wheelchair help you as a coach? Did it force you to focus on certain things and that type of thing? Or
the answer is you had to focus on how you were going to communicate what things were. I was a big person on hand placement on defense. Now I could show hand placement, but I couldn't show foot placement.
Yeah.
So you ended up showing foot placement with your hands.
Mm.
You know, you try to look and say, all right, this is what I've got to show. How can I do it? Well, I can do foot placement with my hands. I can do hand placement with my hands, and I can do foot placement with my hands. And so you think about those kinds of things to see how you do it. And so your thought process, I think, is deeper on trying to identify how am I going to explain what I want to explain.
So why did you leave coaching?
I got fired.
You got fired.
I was 19-5, and I'd cut a school board member's son, which wasn't very smart, he decided that there was time that we had a replacement on the basketball coach, and so I got fired as a coach. I still had a teaching job if I wanted it and so forth and so on.
Wow, so you were 19-5 and got fired.
Yeah.
How about that? There's a little politics for you.
There's politics in all this process.
Yes. Well, but at that time you decided you were done and you didn't want to pursue another coaching job? Or
I pursued two or three other coaching jobs, except what happens is you still got the same problem, even though you've been successful, that places would say, I don't think we want to take a chance.
Yeah.
And I understood that.
You were still handicapped.
Still handicapped. And how were you going to fit into our community? And what was going to happen? And let's be honest, most communities don't have any housing that was accessible at that time. I mean, there was all kinds of reasons for why they thought what they thought.
Yeah. Was that a big disappointment to you?
Yes and no. I went back then and got my doctorate. And had an opportunity to be in the central office, and that was fun, because when you're in the central office, you really do have an impact on having an opportunity to hire really good teachers. And really good teachers are incredible. I mean, you know, you just and that so you have you know you're making a difference in kids' education when that occurs, and so that was fun. But you know, when you had that one teacher that turns kids on, there's nothing like it. You can, it's the old saying that, you know, teachers say the pay isn't always so good, but if a kid ever comes and says, you were the difference why I made it in college, that's a better paycheck than you can get any place at all.
Sure.
And so you had those kinds of things which you could do that made a difference.
So you're an assistant superintendent, right?
Yes.
For Newcastle, and you had a say in who was being hired and so forth.
I was in charge of personnel and then later on was in charge of business. And so those were really sort of my two areas.
Did you hire and fire coaches from that position?
I was involved with it, yes.
Yeah. You had to make that decision sometimes?
Well, it was sort of fun. That was a fun part, mm-hmm. truly. I remember when we hired Mark Surface as a football coach. You know, we're never really all that good. And he was just magic at how he could motivate young people.
Yeah.
And so you would watch it happen and you're thinking, wow, isn't that something?
One-on-One with Ray Pavey continues in a moment.
Well, thanks to Ray Pavey for sharing his dramatic story. You might recall that I talked last week with former Purdue center Chuck Babis, who lost his foot in an auto accident in college. And I talked a few years ago with former IU star Landon Turner, who also was paralyzed in an auto accident. They've set an example for fortitude that anyone can learn from and remind us how silly it is to complain about the little things in life. Pavey, for one, became a successful high school coach before becoming trapped in the net of small-town politics. And then he went on to a career as an administrator. He's the kind of guy who can sit for hours and tell stories related to Indiana basketball. He knows more people and remembers more events than just about anyone, and he's remained well-connected. He's an active member of the Indiana High School Hall of Fame in Newcastle and gets out often to events around the state. Now, if you missed part of this conversation or have a desire to hear any of the others in the one-on-one series, go to the website at 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on one-on-one, click on the podcast link, and they're all there 24/7. I can be reached by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I can be found on Facebook and Twitter, with the Twitter handle being @MarkMonteith. And of course, I'll be back again next week with yet another conversation with an Indiana sports personality, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.